Hello, everybody. Welcome to Silicon Sandbox. This is Steve Chung, co-host of Silicon Sandbox, and we have a special co-host for today's episode, Edward Hartman. Ed, do you want to give a quick hello to everybody?
Yeah, hi, everyone, and thanks so much, Steve, for the honor of having me on as a co-host.
All right, fantastic. Before we introduce our illustrious guest today, a quick reminder for what this podcast is all about. So Silicon Sandbox really aims to put a spotlight on the tech and entrepreneurial scene here in Los Angeles, where we feature entrepreneurs and sort of the movers, shakers who are shaping the technology and innovative sort of landscape in Los Angeles today. It's befitting for that mission to have two amazing guests on our show today. Want to quickly introduce Eric Ranala, who is our founder and managing partner of Mucker Capital. And we also are welcomed by Anne Wellington, who is the managing director of the Cedar Sinai Accelerator. I probably butchered that, guys, whether it's the pronunciation of your name or your titles, but maybe Eric, we can start with you with a quick introduction of what you do and a little bit of your background.
Sure. Yeah, no, you got it right. My last name is a tricky one, so but I'm used to many different pronunciations. Yeah, my name is Eric Ranala, one of the founders of Mucker Capital. We are a early stage venture fund based here in LA. We also run what is ostensibly an accelerator program called Mucker Lab. We started about 9 years ago. I moved down here from the Bay Area about 9 years ago when we started. And my co-founder and partner in Mucker, Will Su, he had moved down to LA a few years prior to that, also from the Bay Area. We had worked together way, way back in kind of the early to mid 2000s at eBay. And he had moved down here and, you know, was in the ecosystem here. And I was actually investing a similar fund in the Bay Area called Harrison Metal. That was me and one partner and one of the earlier kind of seed or micro VCs in San Francisco. And, you know, at the time when we started, the venture infrastructure in LA was pretty anemic. We felt like LA, you know, as a city, as a burgeoning ecosystem, really needed more infrastructure at that very early end of the venture, you know, continuum, if you will. So accelerator, seed fund, and that's what we set out to do. And that's pretty much still what we do today, is invest in very early stage software companies, or software enabled businesses, I should say. So anything that's kind of, you know, either pure software or software enabled business model, and anywhere from very early seed through kind of post seed, early A.
All right. Fascinating. And we'll get definitely into more of that. And maybe I could ask you for a little bit of an intro as well.
Sure thing. So as you mentioned, Steve, I'm managing director at the Cedar Sinai Accelerator Program. And so I think I might have the most fun job at Cedars. I'm not sure. There might be some people who disagree, but I get the privilege of working with early stage healthcare technology startups that have products that we can sort of help accelerate the development of through working with our clinicians and our stakeholders at Cedar Sinai. We started the program about 5 years ago with this sort of recognition that there's so much exciting innovation happening with early stage companies in healthcare and in everywhere. But one of the challenges often is it can be difficult to figure out, you know, how do we deploy sort of early technology in an industry where we're trying to make sure our patient safety is at the forefront, and it's kind of a complex ecosystem to work in. So by bringing companies into the accelerator program, we can really help them accelerate their development, create great products that hopefully we can use at Cedar Sinai and that other hospitals sort of around the country and around the world can use as well.
All right. Fascinating. Are you a brain surgeon by any chance? Or
I play one on TV, but no, my entire background is in healthcare IT. So I've worked at a company called Epic, which most people probably have not heard of. But if you're in healthcare IT, it's one of the largest electronic medical record vendors in the world. And after that, I was at a startup called Stanson Health, which again was on sort of the back end behind the scenes, helping physicians make clinical decisions based on data in the EMR. So lots of sort of cool technology going on behind the scenes at the doctor's office and in the hospital. And I've gotten to do a lot of that sort of tech work in my career.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a ton of stuff I think we can get into. But before we go there, Ed, this is your debut as the co-host of Silicon Sandbox. Our normal MC, Mike Chivas, is busy fixing bugs and engineering in right before the elections come up. So he had to take a pass. But can you explain to us a little bit of your Texan accent and whatever else is going on? How did you end up at Fox? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure thing. My accent's from the deep south. So from Australia originally. Right now I'm SVP of corporate development for Fox, which really means looking at a very broad and eclectic range of investment opportunities for the company. You know, it's a super interesting time for Fox post the Disney split almost 2 years ago now. And we're really reinventing the company from the ground up, as you know, Steve. And so it's an exciting time to be looking at all types of different opportunities across a bunch of different sectors. Prior to Fox, I was at our sister company, News Corp, for a couple of years. Prior to that, I was at a hedge fund called Caledonia, which is a global, largely TMT-focused equity hedge fund. And then prior to that, I'd been at various roles on Wall Street for the balance of my career. So a little bit of a random walk to get to where I am today. But as I said, super interesting time to be at Fox and super interesting seat within Fox, and get the privilege of working with you on a daily basis, Steve. So it's a great place to be.
All right. Okay. I paid Ed to say that. Thank you, Val. Why don't we get into it, guys? I think this, Ed, you have a very unique perspective also from the Fox perspective, looking at lots of companies, whether we invest or buy them. Eric and you both, you know, meet founders all day long probably and work with early teams. You know, some of the viewers that watch us and our listeners have great ideas that only if somebody could recognize the ingenuity of what I'm talking about, change the world. But, you know, I think a lot of people have those good ideas perhaps, but can't take the next step into actually making that a reality. And so maybe you guys have a great sort of front row seat into that process and what it takes. So, I guess maybe right out of the gate, you know, what are some advice, words of advice, sage wisdom that you guys have accumulated over the years of you watching teams grow from an idea to maybe a $1 billion enterprise? You know, what would you suggest if you are listening today and have a great idea? What would be your recommendations and how do you get started? Maybe Anne will start with you.
Sure. When we interview companies and we get, for each sort of class of our accelerator, we usually get about 500 applications, and we'll narrow that down to 10 companies. So we go through a pretty extensive interview process. The first question that I always like to ask when I'm interviewing is, what's the problem that you're trying to solve and why are you the team to solve it? And it's a really illustrative question, because there's companies that have created a cool solution, or they've created something kind of clever and fun, but it actually doesn't solve a real problem for our clinicians, our patients, or the health system. So companies that start from, hey, we know exactly the pain point that we're tackling, and we know why someone would pay us for this product, people who can articulate that really well usually go a lot further than people who try to explain, you know, oh, this is why it's such a clever idea, or this is why this is such a cool sort of gadget or thing, but we don't really know what problem it's solving for the person who's using it. And then the second half of that question, why are you the team to solve it? I think just understanding, you know, what in someone's background brings them the passion to really want to dive in and say, I'm committing 110% to this company. And sometimes it's their knowledge and their sort of previous professional experience. What we see in healthcare is often sometimes it's they were a patient, or their parent or their child that had an experience in sort of the healthcare world, and they saw a challenge that they wanted to fix. So sometimes that's sort of that driving force. But I think understanding the problem and having that driving force for a passion really helps early founders get that initial sort of traction and interest.
Wow.
And I'm curious about part one of that answer, particularly with COVID, obviously probably expanding that as an opportunity for you all. How big a tailwind has COVID been in terms of expanding the opportunity set and the number of folks coming to you with interesting ideas?
Yeah, I think for me, the most interesting thing about COVID has been in healthcare for years, we've been talking about more virtual care, more video visits. How can we sort of increase the use of telemedicine? And it's been something a lot of folks in healthcare have been really nervous about, you know, we need to do this in person, we need to do that in person. And I think like the rest of the world, 6 months ago, suddenly we thought, okay, well, I guess now we're doing as much remotely as we can. And I think that has opened the door to a lot of interesting innovation that we'll see where we're probably in the next, starting now and moving forward to the next year, we're seeing lots of interesting innovation in remote care that where people were kind of waiting on the sidelines of, oh, I've got this great company, if only more people would adopt a more virtual care style. So I think that's an area that we're seeing lots of sort of innovation and excitement. Thanks to, if there's a silver lining, sort of thanks to COVID and being forced into some of this innovation.
Yeah. And Eric, you've seen a lot of entrepreneurs and teams. What would you give in terms of advice and your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, I think you answered your own question to some extent in the beginning. You said, you know, kind of what's the next step? And I feel like that is the key, you know, take the next step, whatever that is, and wherever you are on that journey. If it's literally you have this kernel of an idea in your head, then keep fleshing out that idea. Talk to potential customers, talk to users, talk to people in the industry, and start, if you can, building something. Now, if your vision is to build a new, supersonic jet engine or something, that's harder to start doing nights and weekends, you know, in the garage. But if you're building a software product or a software enabled, you know, model of some sort, start building it. And if you don't have software development skills, find someone who does and that can work with you on it. Right. I think really it's the journey. I mean, going from your idea to being that $1 billion business, I feel like a lot of times on TechCrunch or wherever, it feels like that was an overnight success, but really it's just putting one foot in front of the other for 8-10 years until it's a, you know, and then it's a $1 billion thing all of a sudden. But I think those first few steps are the most critical ones. It's like really with anything, any change in habit or anything you do, it's taking those first steps and, you know, in this case, fleshing out the idea, validating the idea, refining the idea, and then building something, putting it out there, building an MVP, getting, you know, even getting more people to join you doing it. Startups, to a great extent, I think people focus a lot on the product or the insight or the innovation, which I think has to be there. But at the same time, so much of building a startup is sales. It's sales to early employees because you're a nascent business with no revenue and no brand and no nothing. So you have to sell that vision to other people to join you. You have to sell it to early customers or early users. You have to sell yourself even to get on the phone with, you know, early potential customers. You have to sell yourself just to get the phone call. So that's a muscle that I think you can develop with zero funding or without anything, is just start developing that sales muscle, if you will. And that's free, you know, that's sweat equity. And I realize also that not everyone has the luxury of, quitting their job and doing this full time. But again, this is something I think you can do nights, weekends, and if you have a true passion for something or you see this problem that just needs to be solved and you have this burning desire to solve that problem, it probably would be fun for you to, you know, take that on and do that nights and weekends and work towards solving that problem. So I think it's exactly what you said, it's taking the next step and the next one and just getting started.
Always be closing, ABC.
Yep. Yeah.
So
it really is. It's,
you know,
it's interesting you say that, because in my previous role when I was at a startup, I think that was my most unexpected challenge, was when you're recruiting, it's so interesting because, you know, when you're selling to a potential customer, it's their company's money or it's sort of corporate in what they might be purchasing. But when you're recruiting someone to come join your team, you're saying, hey, leave the job you have now, come work for me on this idea that I have, And I think it's going to work, and you should think it's going to work too. And having to have that sort of level of passion and commitment, not just to sell something, but to say, hey, come join me. That was something I didn't see coming when I first was sort of building a team at my startup. And it was kind of the most interesting part of the journey for me. And one of the things I was most proud of at the end was, hey, we built this awesome team. So I think that's something I think early founders might not see coming, but it's kind of fun.
Eric, I'm curious if this crazy world we're living in has been assistive in getting people to take that existential plunge, or if it's kind of scared people, or is there any noticeable change in the quantity of high quality people willing to take that leap of faith?
I think it has. You know, I think in some ways, you know, the past 6 to 9 months, this whole set of circumstances has accelerated certain trends. You know, I think in some ways it has accentuated some of the things that, you know, people's behaviors, I guess you could say. So people who may have been predisposed to take that risk now, you know, maybe even more so, they lost their job or they feel compelled to do it. And then other people who I think maybe were more risk averse or valued the security, maybe now are even value the security more, right? Because they feel like, gosh, if I leave my job and this doesn't work, how can I find another job? I can't even go somewhere for an interview or something. So I feel like in a lot of ways, what we've seen is it has amplified certain things. Now it has changed things too. Like certain industries were really hit hard by the lockdowns and policy early on, like travel, for example. So there have been, I think, somewhat isolated incidents. And then a lot of other trends like, you know, telemedicine or e-commerce or remote work, you know, distributed workforces, those have been sort of accelerated. So I feel like there's been this weird accentuating effect that we've seen both in certain industries and even with people's predispositions, you know, to either for security and not wanting to jump into something or for taking a risk like, hey, this is a good time to take a risk because there's sort of dislocation or chaos and it's a good time to take a risk. So I feel like it sort of cuts both ways. It's been interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the fact that both of you actually have had operational experience on the other side. So right now you sit on the other side of the table asking the tough questions and everybody comes in, you know, 500 people to 10 get selected for Anne. And I'm sure Eric, you have maybe some similar ratios. So, you know, if you can hearken back to your days as a operator or an entrepreneur, you know, what is there I love hearing these, you know, spectacular stories or really tough stories you never even expected. Is there a story or an experience that stood out to you guys when you guys were running your respective companies? And I guess, Eric, you founded your own, you know, fund as well. And that's obviously an entrepreneurial thing versus what you were doing maybe at TripAdvisor, et cetera. But can you guys think of one moment where like, wow, that was incredibly hard or, you know, kind of empathize with the entrepreneurial journey on the other side of the table? I wonder, Eric, if you had one.
Yeah, I've got a bunch. If I had to boil it down directionally, I would say, don't be deterred by, not being in sync with the conventional wisdom. Because I think oftentimes entrepreneurs early on, they have an insight, at least what we look for is a truly unique insight into something. So by definition, that's something that other people aren't seeing, or they're connecting the dots in a different way than other people are connecting them. And a lot of people will look at that and say, I don't get it. That seems stupid. That's not going to work. Or why are you doing that? So I would say in that sense, it's trust your instincts, but trust, but verify, right? Trust your instincts and take that next step and then go verify it with customers and, you know, and building an MVP, doing what you need to do. But I've got so many examples of this. Like even when we started Mucker, I was, living in San Francisco at the time and investing a fund there that was going pretty well and decided to just kind of pick up and move to LA. And people thought I was nuts, literally thought, you know, I'd lost my mind to do that because nine, you know, plus years ago, LA wasn't really perceived as a hotbed of venture-backed startup activity. And But we had conviction on LA and the market, and we wanted to do this here. And it's a slog in the beginning too. You know, when we raised our first fund, it took us a couple of years really to raise a proper institutional fund on this thesis early on when nobody was doing it and nobody wanted to invest in LA, and people would look at us sideways and ask us, you know, why would I invest in this? So I think you're going to get a lot of that early on. And I think if you have conviction and that conviction is backed up or, you know, reinforced with data that you can gather, right? How, whatever form those data come in, you know, trust your instincts and then verify with data and run experiments, whatever those experiments are. And then keep going.
Wow. And Anne, any stories from the battleground in there?
Yeah, you know, I think if I were to combine a lot of stories into a kind of consistent theme, it's, you know, people at their core, people want you to succeed. And so I think, especially when you have an early product in the market and you feel like, oh, it's not quite as good as I want it to be. It's sort of version one or version two, and it's still got some bugs in it or still got some kinks to work out. Leaning into talking to customers about that, hearing their feedback, asking them how you can make it better, really helped for us to sort of build a bond with customers. It helped make the product better. It felt really uncomfortable a lot of the times because it was, you know, you sold us this thing, it's not working quite how we want it to. And there was kind of a defensiveness that makes you think, well, you just don't understand, or you need to like, just wait, we'll release something. But if you can get past that sort of feeling of defensiveness and say, you know, let's sit down, I'd love to talk through how you would like to see this work. They want to see it succeed. They want to see you succeed. And it's a great way to sort of improve your product and improve your relationships. So I think I spent a lot of time at my former company, I was chief product officer. So just lots of time meeting with our early customers and hearing feedback for how we could continue to improve the product and trying to sort of get over that defensiveness or feeling worried about, oh, we're not quite doing what we want to, and focusing on how do we get there.
Yeah, that's good. So, you know, both of you guys are involved in accelerators, and I think many of our audiences know what that means. It maybe sounds self-evident, but what the heck is that accelerator? You know, what is that supposed to mean for people who have not heard about that? So can you guys, yeah.
I have a funny story about this, which is our building, which is adjacent to Cedar Sinai. It has a large decal on the window that says Cedar Sinai Accelerator. And several months ago, a man came to the door and was asking me some questions about the accelerator. And it was a little bit odd. And finally, I realized he thought we were a particle accelerator and that we just had a particle accelerator in the middle of Los Angeles. And so I had to clarify a little bit what we were, but it's true. Not everyone
knows. That'd be cool.
I know. Yeah. I'm flattered you think that we're a particle accelerator. So it'd be awesome.
So what is an accelerator mean for you, Anne? What does that mean for Cedar Sinai?
Yeah, for us, it's all about sort of accelerating, getting usable products into the hands of our clinicians and helping our patients. I think especially in healthcare, but in every industry, it's a challenge to go sort of from day one of the company of we've got an idea and we're starting a company to this is a usable, sustainable company that is sort of doing sales and has really created this mature company. And so we're trying to accelerate that progress. For Cedar Sinai, we feel like it's part of our mission to keep integrating innovation, to sort of foster that for ourselves and for other healthcare systems. So for us, it's, you know, let's see how quickly we can get new innovations sort of safely into the hands of, like I said, our clinicians, our patients, our back office staff. So trying to accelerate the pace of innovation.
I guess on that, and it's fascinating because, you know, it sounds like your definition of success is getting a product that's a great strategic outcome, you know, for your physicians and clinicians. Where then does, you know, financial outcome rank in the scheme of your mission? And I guess they're pretty closely related, given if it product ends up in the doctor's hands, it's going to be by definition of success. But just curious how the interplay between strategic and financial value is ranked.
Yeah, for us, it's, you know, it's about a lot of different priorities. First and foremost, trying to get things that our clinicians will find usable. And so there's always an interplay there between, you know, can we make them more efficient? Can we take things off their plate using technology so that they have more time to focus on interacting directly with patients? And so we really try to find and work with companies that we see that we'll likely use in our health system. Typically, from sort of a strategic standpoint, if we don't see kind of a way to, for it to fit in with us, so like we don't do sort of consumer wellness type apps or things like that, that's just not a fit for where we have expertise. And so we don't usually invest in those through our accelerator.
And so how do we get doctors to show up on time, Anne?
Believe me, we're working on it.
Is that the age-old problem? I guess I can't. I mean, my doctors will kill me. So hopefully they're not listening to this.
Yeah,
but
I hope they don't. But
but I mean, it's. I remember whether it's me or my wife or my daughter, just waiting is half the battle at the doctor's offices. Is that a real problem for the industry?
You know, it is. It depends on the office, but it's definitely a problem. I think we've seen a lot of technology solutions that there's different ways to kind of approach it. So we've seen ones that say, hey, you know, let's text you if your doctor's running late so that you're not sitting in the waiting room, but we can tell you ahead of time we're 15 minutes late. We've seen apps aimed at, you know, helping physicians be a little bit more efficient with some of the documentation and paperwork that they have to do. So it's challenging. We're trying to see kind of as many patients as possible, but it is a real issue. We're trying to fix it.
Okay. All right. Good. And Eric, on to yours. What the accelerator concept? Obviously, you're not related to an institution like a Cedars-Sinai. You're sort of your own goal in and of itself, I guess, with investment returns in mind. Is that the, how do you guys look at what is an accelerator, first of all, for you, and what's success look like for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, the term accelerator, I think there is some confusion around it, or not even confusion. There are a lot of different flavors of accelerator. The term now is pretty broadly used, and you've got things like Y Combinator, you know, on one end of it that sort of created the category, if you will. But, you know, they do it one way. It's a 3-month long program, which is pretty common. And they have hundreds of companies per cohort, you know, for those 3 months, and they run multiple batches. And you know, some people do it smaller and different. We do it a little bit. We do it our own way, I guess, a little bit differently than that. We have roughly annual cohorts, so we don't do the 3-month long kind of program model. It still is somewhat programmatic. I think in general, the term, you know, has come to mean some programmatic way of interacting with companies that investors interact with a company and work with them over a period of time in a more hands-on way than would normally happen when like an angel investor invests in a company or when a venture fund invests with, you know, in a company. It's kind of a more concentrated, more programmatic level of interaction. And then beyond that, when you get into the details, everybody does it a little bit differently. We tend to not have a timeline bound program. We look at them roughly as annual cohorts. But again, there's no start and end date. You know, we'll work with companies for, you know, 12 to 18 months and work with a very concentrated number of companies. So maybe 10 to 15 companies a year in our accelerator context, and then work with them in a really hands-on way. And these are investments, by the way, too. I mean, then there's a whole like incubator concept, and which we are not. You know, we're investing in companies or teams that come to us and they've already kind of started a company or incorporated, or, you know, often they'll have revenue and a product in the market versus an incubator, which I think most people would refer to as somewhere where you're taking ideas and like spinning them up and launching them out. That is not, you know, we're not sort of creating companies, if you will. We're still investing. It's still an investment model, but they're very early. They'll come work with us and we'll work with them over a period of time in a really focused, concentrated kind of hands-on way. And our focus is really on product and go-to-market and that intersection of product and go-to-market, which I think at that stage of the company is usually pretty critical. You're trying to figure out that really that intersection is product market fit, right? Your product and your go-to-market, is there a match there? And how do you then make that, keep iterating on the product and make it more you know, market ready and then scale the go-to-market or make it repeatable and scalable? And that's a lot of what our background as operators was. it was really always at that intersection of product and go to market. So conceiving of products, building them, taking them to market, and then kind of scaling them is what, you know, what my partners and I have all done prior to investing. So that's really what we're focused on.
And Eric, when you say hands-on, I guess, you know, other than capital, what does that mean, and how are you helping these founders, you know, accelerate, I guess?
Yeah, yeah, we tend to be pretty involved, hopefully, you know, usually in a productive way, not all up in your business.
We'll ask them, Eric.
Yeah, exactly. The goal is, you know, not to get all up in their business, but we're, you know, we're getting into the nitty gritty. So it's very focused on, it's very tactically focused. So focusing on business milestones and metrics. And, you know, we have effectively weekly stand-ups with companies, and we're going through the same stuff that you would do as a you know, a startup or a founding team doing stand-ups, which is, what are we working on? You know, what are our metrics? What's working? What's not? What are we going to change? What did we do last week? What are we going to do this week? And really embedding ourselves in the team that way. Now, again, we're obviously adjunct, you know, team members and sort of helping and advising, not, you know, joining teams full time, but we are embedding ourselves to the extent that we're getting into the nitty gritty of what's going on in a very tactical, you know, and especially metrics focused way, in an implementation, at the implementation level, right, of what's going on in the company. And that can mean a bunch of different things, but it's digging into the sales process, helping to even put together what the sales process should look like. Like, we'll go into your Google Ads account or your Facebook Ads account and help set up campaigns or look at, you know, whatever that tactical stuff is, we're getting down to that level. So it's really anything from that tactical level up to the more strategic, you know, quote unquote level of where, you know, where are we going from product and market and all that. So kind of everything in between.
You know, it's funny. I love asking VCs this question, but like the one company that got away that's now worth, you know, $100 billion, that, you know, when you saw it was like, what the heck? Uh-huh. I mean, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know. And in your tenure and Eric, you have, it sounds like you have a longer window of potential opportunities to miss those things. But is there one or two companies, Ann and Eric, that you guys wish you would have taken on, but now you regret and you can't sleep at night when you think about that, or any examples there?
I would say ask me in 5 or 10 years. You know, timelines in healthcare are long, so I'm sure there will be one, but so far, no. So we'll see.
Okay. How about you, Eric?
Gosh, how long you got? you know, there's so much of that. I think, it's so hard to tell, at least when we invest. I think it's hard to tell a lot of times what's going to happen, but when at the stage we invest, I think it's really hard to tell. So there's a long list. I mean, the first one that comes to mind for me was a company that we met really early on when we started here in LA, called Dollar Shave Club, which was, you know, super early at that point. And, you know, to me, it was, you know, simple paths, like, you know, commodity shavers, funny video, no brainer, pass, you know, like,
right.
It's funny how very early on, it's really hard to tell. So obviously those guys went on and sold the company for an enormous sum and have done great and continue to do great things. So I think it is part of this business, to have many, many misses. Now, what you can't do, I think, is lose sleep over it, you know, and stay up at night worrying about it, or frankly have really severe cases of FOMO where you're just always afraid of missing out. I think you really just have to have your thesis and stick to it and keep going. But I think this is a business of misses in many ways, right? Misses where you're going to miss companies and totally not get it, right? Like, I totally didn't, you know, get it with Dollar Shave Club. But also you're going to have a misses in the sense that the, you know, what people call the loss rate in, you know, in venture funds, the percentage of companies that just go out of business, you know, completely, historically has always hovered around like 40 to 50%. So not only are we going to miss a bunch of things, where hopefully not too many, but you're always going to miss stuff, but then, you know, half the things you do invest in are not going to work out, or you know, 40 to 50% are going to severely not work out, right? They just go out of business. And that is just the, and that I think is okay too, where that's just natural, the natural rhythm of this, you know, like, you know, my partner Omar started four companies, you know, two of which went completely out of business, two of which were kind of small, you know, small exits, but nothing to write home about, as he would kind of put it. And then, you know, the fifth company he started was a company called AdMob that was acquired by Google, which is now basically runs like, you know, the bulk of mobile advertising in the world, right? So on his platform. So I think it is a really, that's just the nature of the of startups, you know, investing in them and as an entrepreneur.
And I guess on a no names basis, and with the benefit of hindsight, any kind of common traits or mistakes of things that haven't worked out that you could, you know, if you could wind back time, you'd correct yourself on?
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything totally programmatic, you know, or any rule or rule of thumb that I could say that I'd correct myself on. I think I think for me the biggest, or for us in general, I think a version of that is that what we're looking for first and foremost is a truly unique insight into something, you know, some market or something where the founder or founders have like a truly unique insight, something that other people haven't seen, or when you hear it, you're like, oh my gosh, like, and often it actually just sounds obvious once they tell you, and you can't believe that, you know, nobody's done that before. They just connected the dots for you. You've been staring at the dots for, you know, forever, and they just connected it for you. And now your eyes have been opened, kind of. That to me is the aha moment that we're really looking for. And when we see that, that's when we get really excited. Sometimes you have to squint really hard and, you know, the dots aren't actually connecting, and you have to sort of force the connection a little bit. And maybe those are the times to be a little more wary. And sometimes we just get excited and we want the dots to connect, because gosh, it would be so great if all those dots connected. And I think maybe that's a lesson, you know, that we've learned, is we can't force the dots to connect, you know, but when the dots are actually, or when founders usually have connected those dots and they show us, you know, the connections between the dots, that's when we get excited, and that's when we get excited about investing.
Yeah, and I think as I'm trying to think through sort of what we see in companies we've worked with that have gone on to be successful, or at least stay in business, and others that have shut down operations, I feel like we focus a lot, as we're talking to them early on the founder team dynamic. And I think there's a lot of different ways for co-founders to work together and balance each other. So there's no one right formula, but I do think that when we see really well-balanced teams where each person is bringing in specific skills and they can kind of understand, like, here's how we'll work together now and at scale, that helps a lot. And if there's big sort of gaps there, or they have completely overlapping skill sets and aren't looking to bring in someone else to sort of balance that out, it tends to sort of affect the balance of the whole company. And so I think having that balanced foundational team can be really, really critical to companies.
And at Hartman, I'm not going to let you off the hook. You've done your share of investments and acquisitions. What have you learned through that process? I mean, any things that sort of stood out at you as either a good insight or a bad insight?
I think the biggest learning for me over the last 4 years, I started off my career many years ago as an equity research analyst, where you're kind of trained to be cynical and critical in many ways, and I guess finding ways to say no rather than to say yes. And I think, you know, people are often cynical and critical by human nature. And so, you know, what Eric said really resonated with me is finding ways to think of what's possible rather than finding ways to think of what's not possible is been a learning and a kind of evolution in my thought process. And that doesn't mean saying yes to everything by any means. It's kind of trying to, as I said, imagine the possible rather than simply think of the many reasons why things can't work, because I'm sure Eric and Anne see lots of stuff that to the average eye would think of this can't work, but then you fast forward 10 years and it's the greatest idea in the last 10 years. So I find myself daily having to remind myself to think of the possible and think of ways to say yes rather than straight away say no, because there's always many reasons to say no.
Yeah.
I think that like nails it. The easiest thing in this business is to just say no. There are always a million reasons to say no. The hardest thing is figuring out when to say yes. So I think that's so right on.
And I think specific to Fox, Steve, you know, the definition of what is a media company today is very different to what it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago, or let alone 20 years ago. And so, you know, as we think about rebuilding and setting the company up for the next 20 years, you know, the definition of what is in Fox's fairway to me is very different to what the average Wall Street analyst or, you know, someone a year ago, 5 years ago might have thought. So just trying to think about what is our fairway and what our rights to play in different, you know, new business lines is exciting, but also takes, you know, a process of challenging yourself and thinking what's possible and what we could do rather than what we shouldn't do effectively.
Yeah.
I'm curious, and sorry, I know I'm not here to ask the questions, but I'm going to.
Please, so. Go ahead. Yeah, co-host Anne Wellington.
Yeah, we'll all be co-hosts here. I'm really curious because I know we have a similar sort of approach in that there's things that are traditionally healthcare and then other things that are of interest to us as a large employer and entity that aren't maybe what people think of as healthcare technology. I'm really curious to hear from sort of Fox and media perspective, where do you sort of draw the boundaries on what would be of interest to Fox from a corp dev perspective and what is actually too far from the core? I'm curious to hear more about that.
It's a great question. Look, I think at the end of the day, Fox is a news company, you know, and is built on great journalism and creating great content and pricing great content, distributing it. You know, and over many, many years, the company's built very large and engaged audiences, and the traditional way of those audiences being monetized has been primarily advertising, you know. And so one thing we've been thinking about a lot over the last couple of years is how to still serve those audiences with, you know, content and services they want and need, but, you know, monetizing them in a way alternative to advertising, which is clearly, you know, under some structural pressure. And I think a great example of that is sports betting. You know, Fox was well ahead of the curve when it came to getting into the US sports betting business. It's become a very, very hot space, you know, and all our big competitors in the media space have dipped the toe in varying degrees as well since. But, you know, to the thesis I mentioned, sports betting is a, you know, recently at a federal level legalized concept. It's now up to the states to legalize it themselves, and that's happening on a state-by-state basis. But, you know, sports betting is a way to monetize a highly engaged sports audience, which Fox has. And so, you know, to answer your question, that's, you know, I guess not a traditional media-like business, but is definitely a service that we feel our audience, you know, resonates with our audience and a way for us to monetize our audience. And so, you know, we'll look far afield for similar ways to do that. And you know, another example is a business called Credible, which we acquired the majority of, which is a financial services marketplace. And again, is a way for us to serve and monetize our general news and business audience through providing, you know, a marketplace of financial products. And so nothing is, I guess to answer your question, nothing is off limits, but clearly we have, you know, clear guardrails around what we do and what we're good at. And so it's really thinking of ways that we can, you know, serve our audiences in an adjacent manner, which makes sense rather than a random walk of you know, ideas that might come across our desk. And there's plenty of strange stuff that comes across our desk. So I'm not sure I've answered the question, but that's kind of how we think about things, you know, trying to stay adjacent and in our lane, but knowing that our lane may not be as clearly defined as it had, you know, been historically.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, well, while on that topic, I mean, I think you gave us a little bit of insight in possibly one vertical in the future of media, you know, sports betting. You know, Anne, is there you see so many companies, I guess 500, you know, in each cohort, but what are some cool trends in healthcare tech that maybe the common folks like us don't really know about? You know, is there something kind of hot and trending, especially in post-COVID? What are some insights you can give us in your sector?
Yeah. And, you know, in healthcare, just like everywhere, there's always these trends that we see every year that are really hot one year and then vanish. So, you know, a year or two ago, every company was a blockchain company. This year, I think every company has AI somewhere in their description of what they do. But there are some really, really cool applications in AI and especially around genomics and personalized medicine. So using your genome and all of the specifics about you as a person to make sure we're delivering optimal care. And sometimes that's optimal care in the sense of we want to make sure that you and your providers sort of understand each other and we can deliver things in a way that you most want to hear it. Or at the other end of the spectrum, it can be pharmacological, what medication is best paired to your genetic profile to make sure that you have the best chance of getting well. And so there's some very cool innovation happening in personalized medicine. And then I think we're seeing a lot of trying to figure out things like voice and robotics, how that fits into sort of the healthcare landscape. And so there's, you know, home applications where people are giving updates on their symptoms or conditions to like an Amazon Alexa that can get fed back to us in the clinic or in the hospital. So I think there's some cool sort of virtual assistant type things that will help people stay well and interact with their care teams.
How many COVID vaccines have you been pitched in the last 6 months?
You know, I'm fortunate in that we balance out, we focus in the accelerator on things that we're not working on or wouldn't be worked on in the lab. So I've luckily get to stay away from the really deep biotech stuff. But what I've seen a ton of in the last 6 months are the COVID symptom trackers, COVID contact tracing, and then a lot of the like employee screening of coming back to work. So lots of those out there.
Interesting. So, and it is a little tangential, but I guess, you know, one of the biggest issues that I see as somebody who doesn't know much about the sector is that, you know, for all the faults and, you know, drama of like a Theranos fiasco where, you know, one single drop of blood will tell you everything you need to know, I think there's still something to, you know, having a super easy way for people to get an annual checkup. And maybe you just like walk into a phone booth and it just scans everything and you're out and it just tells you a diagnostic, almost like a car tune-up, you know, and something like that. And if I've always heard that, you know, preventative medicine is a lot more, you know, cheaper than post, you know, sickness, et cetera. So is there anything that you've seen that does that? You know, you walk into a magical machine and maybe it's not one drop of blood, maybe it's three drops of blood, but something that gets at the preventative aspect and making it super easy for everybody to know what they should be looking out for?
Yeah. You know, I think I haven't seen one thing, but I think that is definitely, there's a lot of different trends heading in that direction. So we're seeing a lot of sort of how do people do self-service home, especially diagnostics. So I think most people are familiar with something like 23andMe. Doing saliva samples at home was sort of step one, but we've seen lots of companies that are moving towards, you know, how can we do easy to draw self-service blood samples and bring some of that into the home? A trend that gets talked about a lot in healthcare is consumerization of healthcare. So recognizing that our patients are customers, that we want to deliver an experience to them. I don't want to say akin to like a hotel, because certainly there's huge differences between a health system and like a hotel or a restaurant, but knowing that people have choices where they go to get seen and we want to make it as enjoyable and sort of seamless as possible. There's lots of solutions that are focused on how do we make things efficient and as sort of quick and easy as possible. So I think there's lots of different pieces of that are sort of coming together to try and get as close as we can to the doctor's office in a phone booth.
Interesting. And Eric, I know sometimes you deal with back end or enterprise software or business enabled tech that may not seem as sexy to the common listener, but I know you also are involved in a lot of consumer stuff. Any super interesting trends or somebody connect the dots for you recently that he's like, oh my God, that is a phenomenal that you can give us a peek into?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the areas we actually think is interesting also is that consumerization of healthcare, or just the ability for consumers or patients to have much more choice and control. You know, I think the balance is shifting that way, where, and not even, you know, we have a thimble full of knowledge compared to, I think, what Anne and her team have, but so we wouldn't get as much into like what's going on in the clinical environment, like robotics for surgery and things like that. But more on the patient and consumer and sort of consumer facing business, we would. I mean, we love that trend. And I think it's really the patients are pulling in that direction where they just want more choice and more control. So we've invested in things like a company called Next Health, which is they initially started as these sort of medical clinics. It was started by a physician here in LA doing what you could call sort of preventative, almost like frontier medicine, like, you know, some people would call it biohacking. So they do things like, stem cell therapies or a lot of things like that, IV therapies, a bunch of different stuff. And they do a really extensive battery of tests. So the way that they're taking your blood is not different. You know, there's not innovation around that necessarily. But then the panel of tests that they run or the battery of tests that they run might be different and more extensive than a normal doctor in like an insurance reimbursement environment would run. So they're looking at different things and then focusing on different things, much more personalized. And then the things that they're going to do as a result of that are much different, much more personalized and sort of off the menu, if you will, of your average like internist. And on the genetic front, there was another physician that we invested in, his company, it's called sequencing.com, where again, you can take the results of your 23andMe test, or you can do a full genome, now pretty cheaply for a few $100. And then they have a marketplace of apps, hundreds of apps that you can run your data through that will tell you a bunch of different stuff that, you know, 23andMe is not going to tell you, or these other services won't. So again, it's like putting these tools in the hands of patients, and oftentimes there are physicians involved, right? In these cases, both of the founders are actually physicians. So we like that trend in general, and we tend to be involved more on like providing that to consumers. If there's a demarcation between like the clinical and, you know, robotics and stuff, and then consumer facing, we probably do more of the consumer facing side of that evolution of healthcare. And then we do a lot of boring, you know, enterprise stuff, like you said. And I think the trend there is just that, and this isn't a blinding insight to people, lots of people smarter than I am have said this, which is software is impacting everything, right? Like Mark Andreessen said years ago that software is eating the world. And I think that's true. And it's eating the world, or if you want to go like one level of abstraction down from that, it's eating every industry. And then all the workflows within these industries, within enterprises. So it's either all these workflows are getting software enabled, and those are huge opportunities for things that people are doing with paper and pencil or manual processors or email or, you know, fax machines. We love fax machines. That just screams out that you need software and automation there for that. So stuff like that, we actually love, because oftentimes those are critical workflows in an enterprise that just people are dying to get software enabled. And then obviously those industries are being, you know, disrupted kind of bottom up by software as well. So sometimes it's just coming in from the side and software enabling those industries, or, you know, making them much more efficient, or, you know, much more streamlined or really improving them, or it's disrupting them completely bottom up. So we like both of those as well. And that's happening at an unbelievable rate. And an accelerating rate these days. So we find that really interesting and great opportunity as well.
And Eric, you were well and truly ahead of the direct-to-consumer Curve. I noticed you were an investor in Trunk Club, which I was actually a customer of for a period of time. Great product. Is that still now? And nowadays, everyone's kind of trying to go direct. Is that still a space you're interested in, or is it got too hot for you?
It is in some ways. I mean, so we actually just invested in a company that builds software for e-commerce retailers. So, like, I think so that trend, you know, that's certainly a trend. You know, so companies like Shopify, for example, have been huge beneficiaries of that trend and have driven that trend too. I mean, it's kind of a two-way street where they have enabled a lot of these smaller D2C brands to get going and people to create these businesses and then in turn have created a massive company by doing so. So we like that trend and we probably invest more on the enablement side of that. So the Shopify's of the world versus the individual kind of D2C product brands, but we do occasionally do also direct to consumer brand investments. We don't do as many of them because I think sometimes it's just harder to scale companies in those D2C categories, which is okay. And, you know, this is one of those things where I feel like people might hear that and say, oh, you know, those aren't good businesses or something because some VC won't invest. And I think that's not true at all. It's more just that the profile of a venture, the profile of a business that's a fit for venture capital funds is pretty specific. And usually that the size of business or scale of business that, VCs want to invest in has to be some minimum size for the math to work on, the investment to generate a good return for the fund just based on the economics or math of a venture fund. A lot of those D2C brands have done great and will continue to do great and make those founders, you know, fabulously wealthy and will be fun businesses, but some of them just aren't a fit for us. But that trend is, I think, a great one because again, it just gives more choice to consumers. You're seeing these, thousands and thousands of really interesting products getting launched and brought to market that you didn't have 10 years ago. So I think it's great for consumers. There are a lot of great businesses being built there. And some of which I think will turn into these like massive multi-billion dollar companies that are, really that's the thing that a lot of VC funds are looking to invest in. Again, not because those are, any better than other companies. It's just the venture business model math requires those, the investments to get to a certain scale.
Yeah. So on that point, I guess this is completely off topic, but I don't care because it's our podcast and
your
we can
podcast.
Do this.
Yeah.
which is rarely do we have such a illustrious group to be a focus group on something, but I want to turn your attention to us as a media industry, and I wonder, just from consumers, Eric and Anne, if you as just consumers of media, what do you wish companies like Fox did more of? Like what's missing out there? And there's so much talk about, direct to consumer plays like a Netflix or a, Disney Plus or HBO Max, et cetera. But what's missing in the media landscape from your perspective and something that, a company like Fox could do? This is like free consulting. So I'll turn it over. Maybe Eric, if you have some initial thoughts, and then Anne.
Gosh, yeah, I should have, I needed time to prepare my homework for this one. I think as a consumer, I think what's happening now is great. I mean, in general is that, even things like this, right? Like the trends around podcasts and the amount of content out there, I think at, all forms of content, right? Whether it's audio content or video, short form, long form, there's so much content getting produced now, which I think is great because there's an ability to do it. And what I think is maybe missing right now is a way for it to get really efficiently sort of distributed and matching up the people that are interested and with the right content. Because I feel like there's a lot of content happening. There are a lot of people with very diverse and broad interests but right now it seems kind of fragmented and, at least on some of the more bottom up content that's getting produced. You still have the studios producing or the bigger companies producing content, and that's what's getting to the, some of the masses, but I feel like that hasn't all gotten figured out yet. And this is truly a consumer's view of this because we're not really media investors, but I do think the trend is going in a great direction for consumers in the sense that there is, you know, more content than ever being produced. I think there is an opportunity for consumers to find content that matches what their interests are or what they're looking for. And then I feel like in the middle, there will be something that does a really, or there will emerge tools or platforms that do a really good job of matching those up and making it super efficient to be able to monetize and match up consumers of that content with all the content and the producers of that content that are out there. And then the trick is, you know, how does the business model work? Some of the nichier stuff, like how do you create really high production value content, maybe for a small niche like that? I don't know if anyone, or I certainly haven't figured that out, but I think that will get figured out, you know, and that's a beautiful thing, because when you can make it a really efficient marketplace of kind of consumption and production, that'll be cool. And I think we're going in that direction in a way that it has, the industry never has.
Great insight. What about you, Anne? What do you think?
Yeah, my thought is pretty similar, and I'll get even more specific because I have like a pet peeve, which is I love it when I'm like reading something and then it says, you've used your last free article, you need to subscribe. And there's no middle ground between free and an annual subscription. And so what I love that Amazon does really well is if I want to see a show, I can do one episode, I can do it standard def, I can do it high def, I can buy the whole season. There's a lot of different options between nothing and everything. And I would love to see that more broadly on other platforms, whether it's print media that's online or, you know, movies, TV shows, things like that. I admit that probably there's a reason it isn't already happening that way, because I'm sure there's some economics of that that make it not work. But I really wish it would, because I think for people who do like to consume a wide variety of media, it feels a little bit constraining that in the old sort of print physical media world, I could buy a paper for the day and then I've just got that one issue and it cost me however much it cost. There's not really an equivalent of that in online media of just give me access for a little bit or give me access just to this article or this piece of content. And I would love to see something that makes that seamless, that I could just say, yes, I just want to purchase this one and let's just keep going.
So, well, you guys are both now on the customer advisory board for Ed and Steve here, but no, I think you guys both hit on, you know, Eric, essentially it's sort of discovery and curation or matching, right? I think that's absolutely a friction point. And Anne, I think you're mentioning really like a transactional model that are more micro than a full subscription. And both, I think, hit on a lot of things that Ed and I often talk about in media. So that's actually really, it is really interesting to hear both of you. I did not prepare either of you nor myself for this question, but I'm really glad we asked. All right, well, we've got some more time to, maybe we can round it out with LA, because that's really what the focus of the show is. You know, and I drive, I live in the Hancock Park area. And when I go to work, I drive by Cedar Sinai and I see that glass panel that says Cedar Sinai Accelerator, which now I know somebody there. But, you know, how is LA? I mean, Eric, you mentioned LA being people thought you were nuts for coming down here 10 years ago, maybe. You're more highbrow Silicon Valley friends, perhaps. And I was also in Silicon Valley before coming here, so I know. But what is it about LA? What's good? What's bad? How can we make this? I think we all live in LA and have a shared interest in making this a great place for great companies and entrepreneurs to flourish in. Can you give us a little bit, in case the mayor is listening, what are some good and bad things about the LA scene that maybe people don't know about? Maybe Anne, we'll start with you.
Yeah, again, I look at most things through a healthcare lens. And from a healthcare lens, LA is amazing. We've got amazing world-class universities. Cedars, we're really proud. We were just ranked number 7 on the US News and World Report. There's other top 10 hospitals in the city as well. If we go down towards sort of Orange County, there's lots of biotech, med device companies, and then even up north, things like Amgen. So we have all of the ingredients for really a good ecosystem for healthcare innovation. And I think we're seeing that start to accelerate more and more as, you know, we have our programs here and there's other sort of similar programs around the city. And we see the reflection of that. And I mentioned we had 500 applications for our last class. That came from 29 countries around the world. We've had companies from all over the US and a lot of different countries that say, you know, this is a great place for me to first sort of access the US market and go from here. So I don't think I have any complaints about LA. I think it's all good and I'm excited about how it's sort of growing.
Okay. By the way, where in LA do you live, generally speaking? We don't have to know your address, but
I live Melrose and La Brea. So I'm pretty I walk here often. So I'm pretty spoiled by not having like a traditional LA commute.
We're sort of neighbors. All right. We got to go grab a coffee when the pandemic ends.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. Eric, how about you? What is LA for you?
Yeah, LA. I mean, I would echo a lot of what Ann said. I think also applies even outside of healthcare, right? You look at LA as a city and as an economy, you've got a massive economy, right? So you've got a ton of economic activity. And all of that economic activity is going to get software enabled, you know, some way or another over time. And that's a great baseline to start from. You've got lots of potential customers. You've got companies that are training people up and getting more, you know, kind of software centric, software enabled. You've got a massive technical labor force. So the technical labor force in Southern California is roughly the same size as the Bay Area as a region. So you've got a really, really big kind of pool of talent, technical talent. You've got universities, you've got, you know, three out of the top, whatever, 10 or 15 or 15, 20, I don't remember the rankings, you know, top technical universities in the country with Caltech, UCLA, USC, and then a bunch of other universities, Harvard, colleges and universities, Harvard Mudd, et cetera, cranking out all this technical talent more than any other region in the country, actually. All those pieces and a very entrepreneurial culture, you know, historically, you know, on a per capita basis, LA used to be the most entrepreneurial place in the country. Now the Bay Area kind of overtook that a few years ago, but just a very entrepreneurial culture in general. So I think LA, it's inevitable that LA is going to be a great sort of tech and entrepreneurial ecosystem. And I think we're seeing that happen. That was sort of our bet, you know, 9+ years ago when we started, and we're seeing that play out. And I think it'll continue to play out. And I think it's a lot of it is structural. You know, LA is a big, it has scale and a density that is unique and a big economy and a lot of the right pieces around technical talent, research universities, hospitals, all that stuff. If the mayor's listening, I think there's a great debate about this, like how much can government at different levels do to drive this or not do it. You know, I think hearkening back to, you know, the healthcare theme, first, let's do no harm. I think make it really easy for entrepreneurship to flourish. So that's, you know, affordable housing, keep it safe, keep the lights on, keep regulations from being a burden on entrepreneurs. If you want to, clear the path for entrepreneurship, right? Make it easy for companies to start, make it easy for give incentives to companies to be located in LA and enable them to thrive. I think it really comes down to basics. Like I think it's just keep everything working and sort of help clear a path for entrepreneurs from a policy and regulatory perspective and make it an attractive place for people to live. And I think the rest kind of takes care of itself.
Very nice. And Eric, where do you live?
So I actually used to drive by the Fox office every day. I used to live in Brentwood, kind of up in Bundy Canyon.
Oh,
we
yeah.
now live in Orange County.
So, oh my God. Yeah. Okay. You went way down.
Way down. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm curious, Ann and Eric, if you think that being based away from the traditional bubbles of capital and a lot of your peers is additive to you kind of getting away from groupthink and being a little bit differentiated in how you think. I know LA has become more popular in the VC world recently, but does just being a little bit removed help with your process?
Yeah, I think, it's an interesting culture. There's, and I don't mean to say anything against sort of the Bay Area, Silicon Valley culture, but I think there is a culture there that when we work with companies that are sort of saturated in that and then come down here, you know, they feel like there's a lot of pressure to always be crushing it and always be doing great. And really, it's such a competitive culture there that when they come to work with us and we say, you know, we're going to do a lot of mentorship and we really want to be collaborative, it takes a little bit of adjustment. And so I think there's, in some of these highly competitive hotspots, it's actually harder for, it can be challenging for founders when they feel like they're in that pressure cooker, and to be a little bit away from that where they can take a step back from that culture and really focus on gathering feedback and focus on their product and less on the Silicon Valley sort of rat race. I think it's helpful, but that's my perspective. I don't know. I feel like probably there's people in Silicon Valley who are like, no, you're wrong. The pressure cooker makes great companies. So that's another way of looking at it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, LA, places like LA are a very happy medium, right? I think in the Bay Area, I think there is truth, or there are elements of truth to the whole echo chamber, criticism, you know, or observation, maybe I should say, right? There are downsides to it for sure, the pressure cooker and the echo chamber. There are positive elements too, you know, that the Bay Area or Silicon Valley, quote unquote, is hyper efficient. Information travels very quickly. People have, efficient and overlapping personal and professional networks. So there's this, you know, network centrality that helps things get done and information to get shared and knowledge. And, you know, so that there are elements of it that are really, really positive and can help things get done. But then there are the negative kind of echo chamber elements as well. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you know, it'd be hard to be someplace much more remote, you know, or isolated, or, you know, starting a company in I don't want to pick on any place, but, you know, somewhere, you know, really rural, small town where there's nobody around, it's hard to recruit. It's hard to, you know, have a community or network or an ecosystem, quote unquote. But then you look at someplace like LA, in many ways, it is a happy medium. It's a big city, big economy, lots of people, but it's not this one industry town or monoculture, at least when it comes to tech. So you've got enough scale and enough density to have a really healthy ecosystem, but everyone's not, stepping all over each other, or like it's not a one industry town or a monoculture or echo chamber either. So I feel like in some ways, places like New York and LA, which are, you know, by far the two most active, like largest ecosystems outside Silicon Valley, are a good, happy medium that way. And I think that's why they've even started to more and more attract people from Silicon Valley to move there.
Yeah, go LA. All yeah. Right. So we're at sort of the end of it. I wanted to give each of you, including you, Hartman, a chance to anything you want our listeners to know about or things that we missed. Maybe we'll start with you, Ed, and then Eric, and then Ann to bat cleanup here.
I'm going to end with a plug. I mentioned sports betting earlier. It's not legal nationwide yet, but one way you can kind of get into the arena is by downloading the Super 6 Fox Bet Super 6 app, which is a free-to-play game. We've actually got a game tonight for the presidential debate. There's games every, on the football every weekend and the baseball whenever it's on. So it's a great way to get the toe into the space through Fox. It's free and you can win money. So that would be my plug to end with, Steve.
There we go. All right. Advertising supported. Eric, how about anything you wanted to tell our viewers, listeners?
Well, I'll continue the trend. I'll do a plug too. Like we were talking about, we are huge fans and advocates of the LA ecosystem, and we love meeting entrepreneurs no matter how early it is. So, and we say this on our website too, but there's really, it's never too early. We're happy. We can't obviously answer every email or talk to everyone, but we do love meeting entrepreneurs and look, seeing companies early and helping if we can, even if it's not investing right away. So,
all right.
If you're starting a company, give us a call.
There we go. Is that muckercapital.com, Eric? What is it?
Just mucker.com. Yeah.
Mucker.com. MUCKER.com.
That's That's right.
Okay, there we go. And you got a lot of pressure for you to plug Cedar Sinai here.
I know. Do you need a heart transplant? No. I would say two things. One, certainly if you have a healthcare technology B2B company, early stage, would love to talk to you. I think I'll use my plug time actually to sort of, on behalf of Cedars, thank the community. I know over the past several months, there's been a lot of uncertainty with COVID. And I think it's been really, really meaningful to everyone at the health system to feel a lot of community support. And earlier in the year, there was all sorts of donations, and whether that was in-kind donations and food for nurses and face shields and things like that, or monetary donations, all of it meant so much to the organization and to our frontline caregivers as we were kind of navigating this sort of scary time for the health system. So I just wanted to thank the Los Angeles community for their support, because it's really meant a lot to us as a health system.
Awesome. Yeah, no, echo that. I'm sure we all feel that way. Thank you to the essential workers, especially the healthcare industry, keeping us safe. This was super fun for me, guys. What a treat to have the three of you on the show. We hope you guys will come back again at some point. But thank you so much. And to everybody, that wraps up episode 3 of the Silicon Sandbox. And check us out on foxla.com/podcasts or any podcast platform that you get your podcast from. So thanks so much to our guest. We'll see you next time. Thank you.